Good morning, Word and Lifers. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce John Draper, who will be sharing his reflections on Chapter 4, Welcoming Holy Disorder, How the Prophets Carry Us Through. I've known John for years as a fellow member at Trinity Episcopal Church and through our men's group there. As I mentioned last week, John is a follower of Richard Rohr. And it's been my pleasure to follow his spiritual journey. Through John being ordained as a deacon in 2021, and since then has served in that capacity at Trinity Episcopal Church. In addition to those duties and his continued leadership of our men's group, John serves as a chaplain at Cottage Hospital and runs a mentorship program at Lompoc Prison. And I must add, I think John really enjoys driving up to Lompoc on Highway 1 in his new, really fast motorcycle. You can read more about John and all of our speakers on our website, wordandlife.us. And with that, I'll turn the program over to John.
Good morning, everyone. It is great to be back with you. It's been a moment since last we were together, and I'm delighted that I get to have this time with you. I continue to be a follower of Richard Rohr. One of the little traditions that my wife Dawn and I have together is that we read Rohr's daily meditation together in the morning. And then she's in her room, I'm in my room, and then we exchange our takeaway for the day. And it's just a great way to start the day off. So let me get to my notes. And here we go. And it's interesting to me, and my eye, the reason I notice this is because my eye skims over the welcoming part of welcoming holy disorder. Maybe that's definitely an unconscious, no, I don't want to welcome disorder. I'd rather just, let's just scoot on by that and go from order to reorder without having to have that hiccup in between. But with regard to the title of the book, I love that, Wisdom for an Age of Outrage. Hardly a day goes by these days when I am not newly outraged by some news obscenity that offends my sense of civility. The most recent example is yesterday, the White House came out saying that they were going to use the federal shutdown to stop billions in approved funds for Democratic-led states. What is up with that? What happened to the notion of the loyal opposition? But I suppose the red states could point the finger back if they were so inclined, and it would look like that's part of the problem, isn't it? That both sides of the aisle are so inclined these days. We live in a time when outrage has become the currency of public life. Outrage is loud, performative, and contagious. It surges through our social feeds. It fuels our politics. It seeps into our conversations, unless maybe we happen to be around family where there's diverse opinions and we'd rather avoid it. It promises clarity. Here is the villain. Here is blame. But rarely does outrage deliver healing. In this environment, the simple act of weeping feels strangely out of place, even weak. Yet I think I know I agree with Richard that tears may be exactly what this age of outrage most needs. As is going to need for a while as we start to sort some of this out. Tears, after all, do not lie. They are the body's truth-telling when words are not enough. We're going to hear about Jeremiah next week, the so-called weeping prophet. Let his tears flow as a witness to the brokenness of his people. Jesus, of course, wept over Jerusalem at the tomb of his friend Lazarus. In those moments, tears spoke more deeply than outrage ever could. They revealed love wounded by loss, compassion crushed under grief, and hope struggling to survive amid ruin. In this way, tears are prophetic because they can cut through denial. Outrage often hides grief. It externalizes pain by turning it into blame. But tears admit the cost inwardly. Tears confess, I am not untouched by this suffering. I am not above this loss. They place us in the truth, and the truth, however unbearable, is the only ground on which healing can begin. Tears are also a form of resistance. In a culture that rewards hardness, sarcasm, and cynicism, to weep is one way to stay tender. Prophets do not harden their hearts to survive, they keep them vulnerable. They risk the wound again and again, and it's only through our woundedness that we're going to be able to find a way out of this crazy time that we're living in. Tears resist the pressure to become indifferent, and indifference, after all, is really the real death of the soul. Wouldn't you agree? There is also solidarity in tears. Outrage shouts across barricades, but when we weep with one another, we affirm that suffering belongs to no single tribe, no single ideology, no single camp. Tears dissolve the us versus them that outrage depends on. I hope you can breathe with that for a moment. Tears dissolve the us versus them. To cry with is to recognize our shared humanity, the common wound that makes us kin. Or, as President Obama back in 2008 expressed in his inaugural address, there are no red states, there are no blue states, there is only the United States. My friends, if there is going to be a fresh wind of reorder, and I hasten to add, we are way too early in the cycle of disorder to glibly jump there, although show of hands, it'd be nice to just go from order to reorder, right? Come up with a quick little fix. But when we are ready, perhaps we will have to start there. With an acknowledgement that there is common ground that can still be found in our political differences. Finally, tears carry us forward. Outrage stops at destruction. It tears down but rarely builds up. Tears, however, are part of the passage from disorder to reordering. They wash away the illusions that sustained us in the old order, and they water the ground where something new might take root. In this way, they are prophetic. They not only name what is broken, they also anticipate what could be whole. Tears, then, are not weakness. They are strength that refuses to masquerade as invulnerability. They are truth in a time of spin, tenderness in a time of hardness, solidarity in a time of division, and hope in a time of despair. They are prophetic wisdom because they call us out of outrage and into something deeper, something more human, something more divine. Perhaps in the end, tears are the spirit's quiet rebellion against the shrillness of our age. They invite us to stop shouting long enough to feel, to grieve, to love again, and in that love, to glimpse the possibility of a world made new. So I would like to suggest that the central idea of chapter 4 in Rohr's book is that prophets don't exist to reassure us with comfort or order. They bring about something that he calls holy disruption. Their role is to dismantle illusions, disturb false peace, and shake us out of complacency, not for the sake of destruction, but to prepare space for truth and renewal, and perhaps to look at truth that long has been in our dark shadow and we're unwilling to face. So, as I mentioned, it's been a minute since we were last together. One of the things that I'm doing now is riding my brand new, very fast motorcycle to Lompoc Federal Penitentiary. And under the auspices of something called the First Step Act, that's a bipartisan bill that was signed into law by none other than then President Donald Trump in 2018. And as a result of that bipartisan bill, I teach a 6-month class called Threshold. Its goal is to reduce recidivism in the United States, which I'm sure we all know, we all recognize is a huge problem for us here in this country. And I have to ask, did mentioning that Donald Trump signed something good into law create some holy disruption in our gathering today? I'm guessing that it did. Why? Because it disrupted my very blue political bent when I first read it. But there is more. Hear this: the bill's passage was the result of extensive negotiation and collaboration across the political spectrum. A broad coalition was formed that engaged a diverse set of groups from all the way from the American Civil Liberties Union to none other than the Fraternal Order of Police. And those two groups found common ground on issues like mass incarceration and rehabilitation. Congressional passage was also remarkable. In 2018, remember, less than a decade ago, the revised bill passed the Senate with overwhelming bipartisan support by a vote of 87 to 12. It then passed the House, 300 and something votes, much more than just the red and the blue. It passed the House and was signed by President Trump in December of that year. Progress was difficult at times. Some Republicans, like John Kennedy, opposed aspects of the bill. However, compromises ultimately ensured its passage. Its crucial backing, after initial reluctance, did come from the White House, which was a major force in pushing it through for legislation for approval, particularly the prison reform components. Jared Kushner, of all people, played a significant role in advocating for the bill to the president. and it was signed into law. Trump made it one of the most significant federal criminal justice reform laws in a generation. And since then, into early 2025, 44,000 people have been released under the First Step Act, and Department of Justice reports show promising initial lower recidivism rates for those who have benefited from the law and have taken classes offered to them under the auspices of the First Step Act. And speaking of what feels like sometimes opponents, a June 2025 Supreme Court ruling clarified that the act's sentencing reductions could also apply to individuals who were resentenced after the law's passage. And that was in Hewitt versus the United States. People whose sentences were vacated, thrown out, and must be resentenced still can benefit from the more lenient penalty scheme. And the Bureau of Prisons issued a directive in June 2025 to fully implement home confinement provisions. By the way, I want to see your faces while I tell you this. I get to hang out with a group of guys for 6 months at a time. And during that 6 months, some of the walls start to break down. There's a rule in prison that's whatever's shared about you in prison will be used against you in prison. Can you imagine how isolating that must feel? And so, what we try to do in Threshold is create a family. We're on a first name basis only. We're not addressing each other with last names or titles. And slowly, very tentatively, the men start to trust each other in that group of about 20 guys as they start to share a little bit about their past lives. Not with regard to the crime, but just with, hey, this is how life started for me, and these are some of the struggles I deal with. They have the willingness to do that. And the other thing they do is they share some of their humor with me. Humor extends to, as it turns out, it's not just Jesus that could turn water into wine. These guys are pretty good at doing that themselves. So that's a little bit of humor that they share with me. And they also share with me what they mean, as for them, BOP doesn't stand for Bureau of Prisons. It stands for backwards on purpose. So those are some of the ways that we're starting to open up with each other, which is kind of cool. And that's a part of what I think I would consider to be a successful implementation of this First Step Act. There's been some failures. One notable failure is that bureaucratic inaction has prevented the full potential of the act from being realized. One example of that is an inmate by the name of Thomas, who is in a medium security prison in rural Kentucky and finally got to see his wife, who had spent 2 days driving to the prison to visit him. Not flying, but driving, because she couldn't afford to fly. Thomas had pleaded with the prison staff months ago for a transfer closer to home. His children, ages 8 and 11, could not come with the mom because of school and missed sport practices. The miles between Thomas and his family had a weight all of their own, emotional, psychological, logistical. that is separating inmates from their loved ones, breaking down the family unit, and that breaking down of the family unit by itself extends the reach of prison and turns that door into a revolving door. Long wait lists. I can speak to that. The threshold wait list is enormous. Hundreds of people finally were starting to use other chaplains to facilitate this class. One-off offerings sometimes aren't available. Capacity issues, we can only do 20 at a time. And one of the challenges is the mandate, we have to do it in English. We don't have this program in Spanish, as an example, which is almost 50% of the population that speaks Spanish. And of that 50%, I would say 70% of them are not fluent in both languages. So, against that backdrop, let's look at some of the key points that Rohr is suggesting and how we can welcome holy disorder. To begin with, prophets are disruptors of the status quo. Prophets are intended to be that because they refuse to let people set into complacency, denial, unjust systems. They challenge not only external powers, but also the internal comfort zones of their own communities. Some examples of that: prophets disturb the illusion that all is well, when in fact all is not well, when in fact corruption, injustice, or idolatry are at work. For example, biblical prophets like Jeremiah warned that the temple itself had become a false security system. People assumed God's presence meant they were safe while they were ignoring justice for the poor and the vulnerable. And I think we can all see evidence of that in our own places of faith. Naming injustice, prophets confront kings, priests, and leaders with uncomfortable truths. Nathan comes to mind. He disrupted King David's self-deception by exposing his abuse of Bathsheba and Uriah. Amos bluntly denounced those who lie on ivory beds while the poor suffer. In this sense, prophets act like mirrors that reveal what people would rather not see. And there's also a calling by prophets for radical change. Prophets don't just tweak systems, they demand transformation. Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Jesus alike called for hearts of stone to become hearts of flesh. They upset business as usual by insisting that love of neighbor, compassion, and justice come before ritual or power. What I want to linger with for a little bit, because these 10 qualities of the prophets that Rohr enumerates as distinguishing marks of authentic prophets, I think is a litmus test for us as we evaluate our own willingness and our own fear of becoming a prophet with tears. That's what's needed in our society today. Prophets don't just critique the world out there, which is number one, honestly explaining the problem within the solution. They expose how even our solutions often carry their own shadow side. For example, Rohr himself critiques the church's attempt at purity that sometimes become mechanisms of exclusion. Martin Luther King Jr. critiqued not only racism, but also the moderate church that preferred order to justice. Or what I see frequently is the moderate church that would rather not rock the boat. Let's just keep everything sweet. Or as Sister Joan Chittister would say, folks, we've got to stop being nice. We must always be kind in her book, but nice isn't what's going to get anything to move forward into a reorder of the disorder that currently exists. Richard Rohr mentions Bishop Tutu as an example of what this looks like of speaking the truth to power. When he was the chairman of the South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission after apartheid, he carried the weight of an entire nation's wounds. People expected him to be everything, judge, priest, politician, and healer all at once. But what struck so many observers was Bishop Tutu's ongoing humility. Again and again, when victims came forward to tell stories of torture, of sons disappeared, of daughters killed, Tutu would listen, not with the detached calm of a bureaucrat, nodding his head, yes, but with tears streaming down his face. Sometimes he had to stop the hearings to weep. And yet he always reminded the room, I am not the important person here. The important people are those who have come to tell their stories. That, my friends, is humility. To take the spotlight off yourself, even when you're the chair, and place it squarely on those whose voices have been silenced for so long. And then there was his detachment, not in the sense of coldness, but in the sense of refusing to let bitterness or vengeance control the process. The inclination to pay back with the same outrageous response dictated so much of the South African treatment of the local indigenous people. So when police officers confess to killings, when generals admitted to atrocities, he could have thundered his judgment, right? Instead, he looked at them and said, we are all capable of the most terrible evil, and we're also capable of the most incredible good. Tutu refused the easy division of us versus them. He detached from vengeance and invited everyone to step into the harder, holier work of truth and reconciliation. And one of the things that I love, because as folks from Trinity know, I do have an unredeemed sense of humor. Tutu sometimes laughed in the middle of the hearings, not mocking laughter, but of kind of holy release a laughter that broke the heaviness, that reminded everyone that joy is also a part of being human. He prayed, he wept, he laughed. And in this way, he showed us that true leadership is not about control, but simply about being present in the moment. Not about standing above, but standing with. Humility and detachment together created space for a nation to tell the truth and begin again. By the way, Tim Burnett, as I'm reading my notes, it comes to my attention that I can't see you. So if we're in a
I'm
time
here now.
situation, just speak up, okay?
Well, you're good. I mean, about 10, 15 minutes, whatever you want to do. Yeah.
Thank you. Just let me know because I'm on a roll.
Yeah, around 10:50. Yeah.
Okay, I'll keep an eye on that.
Thanks.
Humility and detachment together create space for a nation to tell the truth and begin again. Canada, I happen to be a Canadian. Went back for the first time a couple years ago. Went to their beautiful museum, the Museum of Human Rights, where they acknowledged their harsh treatment of Indigenous Native Americans, something that our country is still in full-on denial about. It's a shadow that we have not addressed. I think of Germany owning the Holocaust. And sadly, that's starting to change. They're starting to go in a backwards direction with the populist movement that's happening there right now. Number two, the second quality of a prophet is they're humble enough to have some real detachment from their own opinion. As we saw with Tutu, they're willing to let go of their own opinion and listen with empathy to those who committed crimes. Their voice is strong, but not absolute. Abraham Lincoln's famous line, "The Almighty has his own purposes." And I hope God is on my side. But I must pray that I am on God's side. And this is in the middle of the Civil War. Number three, they can still love and respect those with a different opinion. Prophets are not dismissive of their opponents. Their critique does not demonize, but it seeks transformation. Desmond Tutu again embodied this in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They do not need to be right, first, or best. Prophets let go of ego-driven competitiveness. Their aim is truth, not self-promotion. For example, Moses resisting the call, claiming he was slow to speech and tongue. True prophets often come reluctantly, not grasping for recognition. I forget which page in chapter four I made a note, but at one point I basically question whether or not Rohr going on about his vows of poverty and chastity and obedience was a little bit of false pride. But I went back and looked at it again, And I see that what he was really trying to do was to come to terms with it for himself and being vulnerable and authentic, talking about what it meant to be a Franciscan friar and being grateful about how much it let him get out of needing to find a job. His food, his housing, his basic needs all were provided by the Friends, Order of Franciscan Minors. On one hand, it freed him. He didn't have to make his living by selling books door to door, pleasing donors, or chasing a salary. But here's the paradox. The very system that freed him also domesticated him. He was never an outsider prophet like Amos or John the Baptist crying in the wilderness. He was always inside the institution, sheltered by it, and to some extent bound by its rules. His vow of obedience, he admits, meant he could never be completely a rogue. Although, if you read some of what his bishop said about him when he was suggesting that the Eucharist could be celebrated with bananas and fruit juice as much as bread and wine, let's just say that didn't land real well with the Catholic hierarchy. And quite frankly, it wouldn't land real well with the Episcopalian hierarchy. I think I can get a nod from Michael and others. What? Are you kidding? There's no way we could do that. The solution, the religious order that sheltered him, carried within it the problem of limiting him. And yet, maybe that's the deeper lesson, folks, that true prophecy is not only about standing outside and shouting. Sometimes it's about staying inside the very structure that constrains you and speaking honestly anyway. Number five, prophets are all about an alternative orthodoxy, and I invite you to refresh yourself by going to page 167 and looking at that beautiful list of seven things that the Center for Action and Contemplation stands for. It changed my life. Scripture is validated by experience, and experience is validated by tradition, are good scales for one's spiritual worldview. That for me, back in 2013, was worth the price of admission. And then I'm often reminded that if God is Trinity and Jesus is the face of God, then it has to be a benevolent universe. Even when so much of what's happening in that universe doesn't feel at first blush to be benevolent, I'm reminded that God is not someone to be afraid of, but is the ground of being and actually on our side. Number six, prophets should have other avenues to truth in addition to the Bible. It's just not about quoting scripture verses as the tried and true. Prophets honor scripture, but also hear God through creation. Example, obvious example, Francis of Assisi. I believe on December 3rd, we're having, that's a Friday, if I'm not mistaken. We've got a community event in the Labyrinth at Trinity to bless pets that come straight from Francis of Assisi. We're celebrating creation. We're celebrating our pets. And what a great way for the church to reach out to the community. Number seven, prophets are team players. They work in community. They are accountable. They're not lone wolves. The early church in Acts to always discern together. Who are my companions in discernment? I couldn't even spell discernment until I was asked to go into 6 months of discernment with the folks at Trinity as a first step towards the ordinate my ordination of becoming a deacon. And oh my gosh, it created a habit pattern in me so that now at least once a month, I'm together with my spiritual director, discerning the manifestation of the sacred as it comes out in various shapes and forms inside of my life. And with the help of that spiritual director, separating the wheat from the chaff. Number eight, prophets confront the real issue, not a means to power or fame, not for self-promotion. John the Baptist is our example here. He must increase, I must decrease. What hidden motives sometimes sneak into my prophetic stance? Big ouch there, folks. Early on, the response of the men to the threshold class was over the top. They were stroking my ego. Oh, it's so great talking to somebody that doesn't have a BOP agenda. And I immediately tried to excuse my pride by arguing to myself that the long waiting lists were because the men had to hear from me. Threshold just wouldn't be the same if they heard it from somebody else, in spite of the fact that we could start to address the long waiting list much more efficiently. That was a big ouch for me. I had to see the ego drive in the midst of my wanting to help out. Number nine, recognize their motives are mixed, which is basically what I did. Try not to pretend purity. Mother Teresa is a great example of confessing her doubts and her struggles in her dark night of the soul alongside of her service. She never threw in the towel. She never allowed that to distract her. And finally, number 10, prophets manifest the fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. I'm working on the gentleness. My takeaway is that prophets are holy disturbers of the peace. They disrupt false certainties, not to destroy, but to guide us through the dismantling process toward a deeper, truer order. In an age of outrage, Rohr suggests we need prophets, not who merely shout louder, but can hold space or disorder until compassion and renewal emerge. Amen. Thank you, Tim. Do you want me
Yeah.
to do the questions or are you going to do the questions?
I've got them in the chat right now. So
Great.
if you want to read them, that would be great. So folks can, be sent off.
So these are some of the questions that I ask myself, folks. Where do you see holy disorder at work in your life right now? What little moments of cynicism or resentment or blame are welling up for you? Which goes to question two. How do you recognize the difference between cynicism and prophetic critique? If you figure out an answer for that, I want to hear. I'm still working on that one too. Number three, which of Rohr's marks of a true prophet speak to your own growth edges? I talk to you about mine, what might yours be? And finally, how might God be inviting you to trust disorder rather than rushing to a false reorder?
Wonderful. Thanks, John. All right, friends, we're going to have about 20 minutes in our reflection groups. Again, those questions are in the chat for reference for you. You should get a little pop-up now. In a group, you'll be in a group with no less than three and no more than five, hopefully. Let me see here. Make sure I saw our numbers just changed. I'm going to recreate these a little bit. We'll see you back here in about 20 minutes for some more conversation with John. Here we go. All right, friends. Hope you had some fruitful conversation. Looking forward to the dialogue that will ensue here. So, John, I don't know if you have any opening words. Otherwise, we can just welcome any comments or questions.
Let's welcome them.
Okay.
Right, well, I'll say something.
Okay, go ahead. And then we'll do Catherine next. Yeah, go
I'm
ahead.
sorry. All right, okay. Well, I just the one insight that I had was well, we had a wonderful conversation, and thank you for that very provocative and interesting, filled with personal examples presentation, John. Thank you, Deacon John. But one insight was for me around how do you recognize the difference between cynicism and prophetic critique is whether or not the critique has a sense of possibility of the person. Not that you're saying you have to develop in this way, but it's offered with a sense of spaciousness and possibility, not like I'm passing judgment on you and there's no room for you to grow or change. It's just this is what I think of you, you know. But if it's said with a sense of possibility and hope, it has more potential, I think. But how to do that? That's tricky.
Indeed, it is tricky, especially when the inclination towards judgment and over under, appearing to be better than all of those egoic
Oh.
agendas—that's. That's when things get tough, and it's amazing how much can just slip out in a passive aggressive kind of a way, right? We talk about that a lot at Lompoc. We talk about something called assertive communication, which is be firm, be respectful, and be simple. State your truth as simply as possible. But even with those kinds of guidances, it's interesting how the guys inside recognize that passive aggressive is probably their biggest challenge. And certainly is mine. I have a tendency to default to that. So thanks, Jenny. Taking judgment out of it is a big step in the right direction.
Catherine, you want to go ahead?
Sure. We had a fruitful discussion as well, so thank you for those questions. And thank you for your deeper dive into the power of tears in the way that you did it. I appreciated that. And I was telling my group I went to a retreat at La Casa with Dave Rico and Radley Weininger, and I brought up the issue of this cascade of overwhelm, and every day's a new day that you spoke to, and just feeling buzzy, overwhelmed by that. And one of the gentlemen there said talked about undefined fears. And I found that so powerful. It resonated. It's like, oh yeah, I'm not just have one fear. Every day is a new fear, or it's a cascade of fears. And then Dave Rico said, and unclaimed grief, which you spoke to. And I went away from that thinking, yeah, maybe if I'm more in touch with that, maybe that would be helpful. Because whatever, every day is not working for me. Oh, I'm, trying to just juggle like many of us probably are in our minds. But so could you speak a little bit more to either of those concepts, or do you does that bring a thought up for you? So
No,
quickly.
thank you for bringing that up, Catherine. I had a whole section on primary emotions, but we ran out of time. It's interesting, and Dave Rico, by the way, is somebody that initially turned me on to this whole notion of primary emotions. And as I was becoming a chaplain, we spent a lot of time with a fellow by the name of Mark Solms, if you want to write that name down, Solms. And he wrote a whole book on something he calls the hidden spring. And as it turns out, at the base of our brainstem back here in the amygdala are seven primary emotions that have been with us since God made us, since God made mammals. 160 million years old with seven primary emotions. You talk about instinctual, my goodness. And the two or three that we're talking about right now is rage. And then there's also the primary emotion of fear. And then there's the primary emotion of panic grief. And panic grief has to do with the tiers of things. It's the fear of separation, so the cub or whatever, the baby can't see its mom and starts to whine and whimper and everything. That's the panic grief part of it. And it turns out that panic grief, which is where the tears come from, is actually a healing agent and a help. And it helps us to move forward with managing our outrage at things and also managing our fear. So yes, I'm absolutely, I think you're onto something there. Grief is a part of the solution. Being open to it, not being. One of the things that I do, I just add this, is that usually when I'm called in because a death is about to happen or has happened at Cottage, I really only have a triage moment, if you will, with the family and their loved ones. And in that few minutes, I just want to reiterate to them that grief comes at us, processing grief comes at us in waves, and we need to be patient with it and not try to repress it or bury it down. But in all of its various iterations, anger, denial, anxiety, all of those things as they manifest themselves, just give yourself permission to experience them. And hopefully, you've got one or two folks that aren't going to fix you or try to fix you when you're feeling that grief, but they're going to walk alongside of you in that moment.
Yeah, Alice, you want to unmute and go ahead. And then we'll do Lee after that.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yep.
Thank you, John. Beautiful, wonderful, personal talk. I just enjoyed it so much. And I wanted to share that one of the persons in our group mentioned what a good model you make for us in our response to our disappointment with this president and our anger towards the things that are happening and that he's doing, and that you took time to point out that there's more to him than that, and that he actually had done some things that were very positive and very good. Anyhow, I just wanted to say it seems like a small thing, but it's not. And it's good for us to remember that there's more to people than just the negative that we see. So thank you for modeling that for us.
Well, Alice, you are welcome, although I can't get the smile off of my face because it's a work in progress for me. I don't know if you guys recognize this, but that's not a picture of me when I was a little kid. That's a picture of Donald Trump when he was a little kid. And what, about 3 or 4 at the time? And I carry it around in my journal because I need a daily reminder. I need to remember that at once upon a time, Donald Trump was a little 3-year-old that did not know how to defend himself against the dad that, luck of the draw gave him. And,
And now he's a 12-year-old bully.
It brings tears to my eyes, but personally, and then there, I just want to reiterate. And then there are moments when I go, I don't see it. You're just a big bully, period. And I can't see past it. So it's a work in progress.
Yeah,
Thank you.
Lee, if you want to unmute. And go ahead, and then I see Karen and then Marianne. Lee, you just need to make sure that you unmute yourself. We can't hear you right now. We can't hear you till you unmute.
Okay,
Oh, there you
maybe
go.
I think I just unmuted, but I need to turn my picture around somehow.
Yep.
I don't know how to do that. Well, there is my unmade bed, everybody. Boy, that is just one unmade bed.
You can
And
turn your phone around if you want to just face it at you while you talk.
Okay.
Just flip it so that there you go.
You can see me now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, I guess I had a little bit of a question when we were talking about primary emotions, things like rage and fear. My question is, I feel fear as I'm in the desert right now, and how do I move to panic and grief? Is it or anxiety and grief, because mostly I'm in a place of fear, and I guess I kind of am touching on anxiety, but how do I get to the grief? Because boy, I sure do want to move away from fear. So that's what I had was a question, really.
Thanks, Lee.
Okay.
Thank you, Lee. There is no ready answer for that. Each one of us deals with it differently, and what works for me might not work for you. But when I'm afraid, if I have a moment, I try to remind myself of some of the things like that I feel like I've lost. And when I remind myself of the things that I feel like I've lost, that helps me to turn to grief and takes me off of the focus on fear. But Lee, that works for me, wouldn't necessarily work for you. But grief has something to do with feeling like something is missing that used to be there, if that helps.
That does help. Thank you.
All right, Karen, do you want to unmute and go ahead?
Okay, I basically wanted to just thank you for putting on the CAC, the podcast they did.
I must admit, sometimes some of them are a little slow as far as so with Richard, it's kind of you just want to speed it up. But on one of the last ones, they mentioned a poet, Drew Jackson, and he's got a book out that says God Speaks Through Wombs, Poems on God's Unexpected Coming. I don't know if you can see this, but this is the book. Anyway, so I got it. Oh, it is so wonderful. And it just goes through and it's based, all his poems are based on a scripture passage. And I just would like to read this real short one since Jackie Reed's not here. I feel we need some kind of poem here. But it's based on Luke 3, 1 through 2, and it's called Alert to the Times. Wake up. The hardest work is to keep from being lulled to sleep, to resist glazing over of my eyes, and to stay alert to the times. These are tyrannical days. Power is used in diabolical ways. Disease agents will keep them off my back, but they will remain on our necks. So what's next? This is a game of loyalty. Who will I be in this moment of history? And it just is kind of reminds me of where we need to be and to just keep in with the small remnants or whatever to work towards what God and Jesus wanted us to do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
You're welcome.
Could you put the information about that author in the chat?
Sure.
Thanks.
Get my mute.
Well, I know we're about at time, but Marianne, did you have a comment you wanted to make before we hand it back to
Yeah,
Michael?
a quick comment. We were in our group talking about this stage of disorder and really being, a call to breaking down, breaking our consciousness from that dualistic kind of thinking. And it's really a shattering of that to prepare us for that new arising, that reorder, which is a higher state of consciousness. And I go back, John, to that picture of Donald Trump as a little boy. And what I am called to do, and as a therapist, a psychologist, is to the adult person to have great compassion because he's still so broken. And it brings me to tears. Yes, I have anger and rage and all of that, but the primary emotion I have right now for this broken human being is compassion and sadness, and that brings me to tears. And out of those tears, then I think, we can begin to find some reconciliation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marianne. I would agree.
All right, Michael, you want to unmute and close us out here?
Well, thank you, John, for a very thought-provoking morning. I was so anxious to hear you speak. I neglected to ask Tim to lead us in our word and life blessing. So I would like to do that now, if you could do that, Tim, and then kick it back to me.
Sure thing. Here we go.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
Thank you again, John. Next week, our speaker will be Professor Kathleen Moore. Dr. Moore is a mother, scholar, author, nature lover. And coincidentally, like John, she was ordained in 2021 as a deacon in the Episcopal Church.
We were ordained together
Oh, that's even more
at St. John.
serendipity, isn't it? Oh, my goodness. Oh, well, she'll be reflecting on chapter 5, Jeremiah, the patterns that carry us across. And I would add, I was reminded in my group this morning, my breakout group, to listen to the podcasts that we're posting from the center of from the center. So I commend that to myself and you as well. I look forward to seeing everyone here next week. And with that, let's unmute and say goodbye to John.
Thank you. Goodbye, John.
Bye.
See you
Bye.
Soon. Bye. Thank you.
Goodbye. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you all.
Good to all.
Wonderful morning, John. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John.
Take care, y'all. See you soon.